This is part two of the interview with Russell Shaw.
Who writes your ads?
Wendy.
So you're doing that in-house?
Yeah, we do it in-house. I wouldn't waste 10 cents on an ad agency to write it.
Who's performing the ads? Sounds like you are.
That's me.
Have you ever had anyone else do it?
No.
It's always been you?
Me. I'm not saying you couldn't use someone else. Like if the person isn't going to do well on camera, or isn't going to do well on a voice, I would tell them, like, if they're not going to do a comfortable job, they would be better off to get some, like, a celebrity endorsement type thing, you know, like somebody, one of those, I don't know, Rush Limbaugh or some person at the station who's well-known. They'd be better off to just pay them a couple of bucks and have them do it so that they would have that comfortable read. That's really important.
Have you tried any of those type of formats where you're talking to a local DJ?
No, it's not anything I've ever wanted to do, but I have a background in radio. And I have a background in, and I've studied marketing so extensively, I think that I get more bang for the buck and more oomph by me personally doing them.
You're dropping a lot of hot points into a very short period of time. You're talking for 60 seconds, and I have maybe 9 or 10 points that you hit. Did you read those all at one time, or did you read them and edit them together so you could get them into a tight little bit of time?
Both. Again, I'm going to tell you, if you're doing radio ads and you start, do not listen to the people at the station. You do a cold read. That means no music. And they'll tell you that you have to use music. Well, then run your ads on a different station. Don't do it. The other thing is don't run 30-second spots. Run 60s. On TV, you go 30. On radio, you use 60s. You only use 60s. If you're an unknown commodity, you have to use 60s. 30 is not going to be enough time for you to get your message out. The message is, because you have to say your name, you have to say your company name, and you have to say your phone number at least twice. That's about 20 seconds, by the way. And the message, the whole point of it is I'm going, if you need to sell your house, we're the ones you want to hire. That is the message. And we have benefits that ordinary agents don't give you. But when I was a new agent, not new, when I was a new lister, and I was going in to a neighborhood, and I'm a relatively new lister. At the time, I was working softcore FSBOs, and I was up against agents who were giants. I mean, they dwarfed what I was doing. I can say I've passed every one of them now, but at the time I hadn't passed those people. They were all quite a bit bigger than me. They were established agents. Well, the first thing I would do when I would go into an area is I would ask the people, I say, you're probably wondering why you should hire me. Well, what are they going to say? No, we're not wondering that. If I was in the house, they'd go, yeah. And I say, well, let me take that up, as though they've asked me the question. And I'd say, it depends on who you're comparing me to. If you're comparing me to an ordinary agent, there's quite a few significant reasons you'd want to hire me. But if you were comparing me, and then I would list off the top agents who work that neighborhood. Like if I was out in Chandler, I'd go, and if you're talking about Bill Ryan or Mike Mendoza or Paul Pastore, these were all friends of mine, by the way, but these were the top agents in that part of the valley. I mean, unquestionably, and there wouldn't be a seller I was saying this to who wouldn't have known their name. If you're talking about one of those agents, well, no, that's different. They're great agents. So if you hire any one of us, you're getting a great agent. Now, that was right out of the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. It's the concept of positioning, and I'm positioning myself in a line. I wasn't positioning myself as against these guys. I was aligning myself like I'm like them. The truth of the matter was, at that time, I wanted to be like them. So it's a matter of like how you're going to be thought of, and you get to pick it. You can causatively decide, here's how I'm going to align myself. And that's what I was doing. So I started the concept then of if you were talking about an ordinary agent, it was a difference, and I would just align myself with successful agents.
How frequently do you try to play the ad?
Well, The question is a bad question. It's not a matter of how frequently you'd play the ad. It's a matter of how much money are you going to spend. Like when I started, like you don't want to try to buy cheap ads. Like people go, well, I can get on this station, I can get 60 ads for X number of dollars, as though this is a meaningful statement. It's a gibberish statement. Or I can get, they'll only charge me $400 to run the ad 25 times, as though this means something. It means nothing. You could be paying $500 for a radio commercial that ran in morning drive time. You could be paying $500, and it's a bargain. You could have some other spot that is $25 on a similar station or on the same station that runs at 3 in the morning and isn't worth $25. So what you're really looking at is what's something called cost per point or cost per person reached. That's the important number. And so when I started, I was on the biggest station in town, the news station, News Talk, and I could only afford 3 commercials a week. I ran them all on Wednesday, one in morning drive, one in midday, and one in afternoon drive. So once a week, I was on the station. The public perception was, since most people pay little attention to things, is I was there every day. But I could only afford, at that time, now if I said we're on pretty much other than this, that this is an election year, so you get bumped on TV stations big time, just based on the demand, because we're on an annual contract, and I'm not going to pay the crazy rates that we'd have to pay to this time of year, like between now and November. We get about half of our TV spots are just getting kicked back. They just literally send our check back and go, we can't run the spots. We can't honor the price we gave you. But normally speaking, I would say we're on every network station, every day, somewhere, all the time, and I'm on all the radio stations we use every day. My media budget, I mean, if we spend about $400,000 a year on television, probably about $200,000 on radio and about $200,000 on the mailing. So we spend right at $800,000 a year on marketing. So it's a lot of money, but it's a big business.
It sounded like there are certain times of the day that you want your ad to appear. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely.
And what times are those?
Well, if we're paying for the spot. Now, if they want to comp some stuff, if they say, we just like you, we want to give you some free commercials, they can run them any damn time they want. But if I'm going to pay for them, I don't want any commercials on certain holidays. Like, I'm not going to run a paid spot on Mother's Day. Father's Day is fine. If you say, why is that true? My answer is, I don't know, but it's true. Like, I didn't find Father's Day to be a bad day to run an ad. I found Mother's Day or days like Easter. I'm just telling you, these are just days I don't run paid commercials. I don't run the last 2 weeks of the year, and I don't want to run a bunch of stuff competing with Thanksgiving as people are getting ready for it. I don't want to run them on Valentine's Day. I don't want to run them on St. Patrick's Day. So you take these days that people, their lives are disrupted by something, I don't want to run a spot. Now, I want my spots, that matter to me, to run between 5:30 a.m. and around 8 or 9 a.m. for morning. Middays, I don't care, just run them in midday time. And afternoon drive time, I want them to run preferably before 7 o'clock. I'm not interested in reaching the people listening to radio at 11 o'clock at night, and I'm certainly not trying to reach the people who are listening to radio at 3 in the morning. But if the station wants to give those to me, if we, you could be on a contract and they go, we're just going to give you a bunch of extra spots, and we'll go, fine. I'm never going to go, no, I don't want them. I don't do it. But we don't want to pay for them if it's not in the times we actually do them.
Are there better days of the week?
Well, maybe. Yes and no. On some stations, it's going to depend on the format of the station. You would find that on certain stations later in the week, you're competing with car dealerships, you're competing with restaurants, nightclubs, that kind of thing. So Thursday, Friday, sometimes the stations have less inventory. Radio commercials are not sold on the basis of ratings as much as they are on demand. This is the same with television. Like, big stations don't even bother with a rate card anymore. They haven't, I mean, I haven't seen a rate card from a company we've done business with in the last 20 years. They don't even use them. They just, it's whatever the traffic will bear. So when they have a higher demand for something, they'll charge more for it. So is it a big advantage to me to be competing, say, on a Friday with a nightclub? Not really. I don't get a bigger kick out of it. So the nightclub really won't want to run ads on Monday. I'm fine with Monday. Do you understand what I'm saying here? So I want to look at where can I get the best deal on the cost per point.
And you found that to be early in the week?
Yes, yes. Normally speaking, the answer to that is yes. But it's a little more complex than we'd probably be able to cover. But I would say there's not some disadvantage. Like, I don't need to compete. Like, running into the weekend doesn't help me.
Do you advertise on the weekend?
Well, seldom. We seldom do.
You'd like to keep it during the weekday?
Yes, yes.
How often do you change or modify your ad?
Probably not often enough would be the correct first answer, because there's a certain pain in the ass to doing it. There's a certain, well, it seems to be working fine. But the problem is the ad has to always reflect the public's perception of the market. For example, in 2006, oh, here, let me give you a different. In 2008 or 2009, my ad said, I can sell your house in spite of the market. Running an ad like that in 2006 would have been crazy. A busboy could sell their house.
Russell, what's the difference between doing a radio ad and a TV ad?
Well, TV is considerably more expensive. TV requires a lot more work, a lot more production values than radio. If you need to redo the ad or it's not quite right, if anyone's listening, I would say start with radio. Do not start with television. I have people routinely ignore that, and I go, oh, well. But I would tell you radio's easier to do, easier to get going, easier to test, and I just think it's easier all the way around. So anyone that's thinking of that, I would tell them absolutely start with radio, don't start with television, because it's just so much faster.
When you do move to television, are you just taking the successful radio ad and adapting it to television?
Sort of, but that's where it gets trickier, because you only have half the time. Like, when I say you have half the time, let me think of a different way to say this. Let me equate it to cost of the ad. A 60-second spot on television cost exactly twice as much as a 30-second spot. So you would have to spend twice as much money to run 60s on television. Television is a more powerful medium, but you don't have the same time for your ad copy, certainly the verbal part. You have the advantage of the visual if you're going to use it properly. Now, go to radio. Radio, a 60-second spot does not cost twice as much as a 30-second spot. They'll still try to sell you 30s. They'll try to sell you 15s because they sell them for proportionately more. But the truth of the matter is you don't have time to get your message out in a 30-second one. So you have to cut your ad in half, and you have to take half of it and put it on the screen. Not doesn't no longer come out of your voice. And it's just trickier. Like, is your smile, does it look sincere? If you're doing a radio commercial, your smile does not have to look sincere the entire time. If at the very end you have a funny look on your face when you're doing a radio spot, it doesn't matter. On a TV spot, it matters. So you might have to redo the whole spot, or I don't know. I would just tell anyone, if you're going to do it, start with radio. It's easier to test it. I found that television, it took quite a bit longer from the time we started running ads on a station, since I run on the news, to get it to work, to see if it was working well. Where radio, I can test an ad. I mean, I can test a station and just spend $1,000 in 1 week and go, yeah, it's a crappy station, I can skip it. Or it's a wonderful station, we're going to continue with it.
If you were to spend $1,000 on radio advertising, how many ads does that buy you?
it's the wrong question. You go back to that cost per point. You're not buying a number of ads, you're buying a number of ears. You want to get away from how many spots do you get for $1,000. It depends on the station. So if you're going to do this, the first thing, be like, let's pretend you're going to do television. And they say, what about cable TV? And I go, yep, if you want to be thought of as a local jerk off, you go right ahead and do cable. If you want to be perceived as a giant, this is the deal, go network television. Go on network stations. Now let's go back to radio. So if you're going to run, if you say, what is the most successful action? The answer would be run an ad on a station that is the station. If something horrific happened, everyone would tune to in your area. Now, that station, by the way, happens to have the highest advertising rates of any station around. So how many spots do you get? It doesn't matter how many spots you get because you're buying on a, you're getting that giant station that has that giant audience. So I'm not trying to buy a high number of commercials. I'm trying to buy a high number of ears. So like when I started, again, I was on three times a week. I could afford three commercials a week. Like my $1,000 when I started was three commercials a week. I ran them all on Wednesday. I just don't want to run it all in one spot because if people happen to tune out for some reason, now I've just lost them all. Sometimes you can go the other direction. You got real lucky. You happen to pick a time. But if you were running a couple, three a day, you should be fine.
If somebody were just trying to start this up, how would they test radio station for that week? What's their objective? Are they trying to get in front of people during a certain time frame, a certain number of people, a certain frequency? I mean, they don't just want to put one ad.
It's limited by your budget. You don't want to run one ad. You don't want to run one ad.
You do need frequency of some kind.
Yeah, but you're not going to do one run ad and go, it didn't work or it worked. That's just like if someone says, I have a budget of $300 a week, what station should I be on? Let me answer it real quickly. None. Don't go on a station. Don't even think of going on a station. Take the money and buy lunch for your friends and ask for referrals. Do not consider it. In a major market, if you're not prepared to spend, for starters, a couple $1,000s a month, for starters, don't do it. It's just not something for you to do. And you need to be prepared to bankroll it for at least 3 months before you collect any money anyway. And that's if you're doing short sales, make that number 6 months. So it's not for everyone, and it most certainly wouldn't be like if somebody goes, well, how will I? You'll know it's working by is the phone ringing. But you don't get paid right away from it. So I would absolutely tell someone, like, you have to get enough exposure to where it mattered that you did it, but still, I just couldn't overemphasize this. It's not the cost per commercial. Like, if they say these commercials cost $400, is that good or bad? I don't know. It's an incomplete question.
Do you have a number you're trying to target, a cost per ear or a cost per person?
Yeah, I want to be at that cost. It's called CPP, cost per point. I want to be as close to $100 or less than I can get. I don't want to be paying $200 a point. I won't pay $200 a point. At $180, I'm probably not going to buy the perm commercial. So I want to be like at $125, I'm okay. I want to be, it's the CPP, and I don't want to pay more. I want to be as close to $100 for that number as I can get. And that's the number that matters, not. And I'm not interested in stations that heavily favor women, like soft rock stations that have primarily female audiences. You'll get lots of calls with fewer people telling you to come on out to the house. Women like to shop. Men don't like to shop as much. So I want a station that has a predominant male audience. That's number one. Number two, I do not ever want to be on a station that tells me they have lots of home buyers. I'm not interested in home buyers or a young, hip audience. You want to avoid those stations like the plague. You're not looking for home buyers. All ads that advertise, if you're advertising on the radio, you're not a home builder, you're a real estate agent. You cannot ever advertise yourself to buyers. You can go ahead and try it. It won't matter. You'll waste all your money. Like all ads aimed at buyers are advertising houses. Buyers are not looking for an agent. They're looking for a house. They're willing to tolerate talking to an agent to get in the house. But they're not looking for an agent. There's some people go, oh, yes, they are. And I go, well, you go ahead and appeal to them. But I'm telling you, the broad public, they're not looking. So if you're advertising yourself and your services, by definition, that ad is aimed at sellers. So any station that has an audience of people well under 40, you are advertising to the wrong people. In fact, I prefer 55 plus is their skewered audience. That's who I want to advertise to because that's who has houses to sell. So it's a different thing, but you're talking, it's the demographics. I mean, who are we targeting? The answer is older people. The grayer, the better. I'm totally serious. Like if you want it to be a successful ad, if you're on television, for example, a real bargain deal is 5 o'clock, 5 a.m. news on a network station. You can get TV spots, 30-second TV spots that run for $150. That's a deal. And the people that sell the ads will tell you, well, yeah, but you want to be on the 10 o'clock news too. No, I don't. Not at what you sell those commercials for. I don't ever want to bother with the 10 o'clock news. It's a ripoff. If you're if you're trying to reach 30-somethings, it's fabulous, but I don't care about reaching them. So I'm looking for the old. You say, well, the people I'm looking at, half of them already went to bed by then. You understand? So it's just a different thing. So I'm looking for an older audience, but you're looking at the cost per point, not the cost per commercial. So whether a TV commercial or a radio commercial cost $500 or $800 or $50, if somebody says, well, isn't $50 a good price? No, I don't know. Maybe it's a terrible price. I don't know. I'd have to know what is the cost per point. What are the ratings? What size audience do they have at that time? So if you miss that one step, you could spend an awful lot of money and get no result that ever mattered because there wasn't much of an audience.
When you say point, does that mean a percentage of the population?
I don't actually know. It's a percent of the people listening in the radio, like it was called Arbitron. It's a rating service. It's a percent of the market, like the share they have. But the number of points is per 1,000 people that they have. I think CPP is cost per 1,000. Of people that they supposedly have watching or listening.
Russell, we spend a lot of time on radio and TV, which is your expertise. I would like to hear a little bit about this seller seminar, and you combined it with a newspaper that you're mailing out.
Well, they've been short sale seminars.
So these are short sale seminars.
Uh-huh.
First of all, why do a seminar as opposed to a listing appointment?
Well, that's an easy question to answer. And a matter of fact, if somebody wants to see the data on the seminars, if they go to nohassellisting.com, my main website, and just click on the tab that says short selling, it'll take you right to my short sale website, which will tell you what the seminars and how we promote them. And we do email blasts out on those too. But the reason is there's a ton of people who are not willing to, they're not ready and they're not willing to list their house, but they're in the exploratory stage and they are willing to come to a seminar where they can get their questions answered. And we do not have a sign up at the end. I mean, we don't try to enroll them or something. We're literally giving them information. We're giving them information so that when they are ready, but we get people at the end that literally go, how can we sign up? We just tell them, just give us a call. Just give us a call whenever you're ready. We'll be here. It's a real casual thing, but we spend about 90 minutes just literally covering their questions of what is a short sale, what are the potential liabilities, why you should do a short sale rather than foreclose, that kind of thing.
How often do you put these short sale seminars on?
A couple times a month.
Where are they done?
In my office. We have a large conference room, and we do them there.
How many people typically show up?
Well, that's changing. The smallest one we had was around 4 people. The biggest one was just under 40, which was a real tight squeeze in that room. But normally speaking, we have about 20 people there.
Of the 20 people that show up, how many of those do you think end up signing up with you?
Well, I would say most of them. We get people who have their house listed with other agents showing up. We're almost at the level of we're sort of perceived as like a public service kind of thing we're doing. It's a different type of positioning. So the bulk of them that come, I mean, that's our main, for short sales, that's been our main procurement line. Like the bulk of the people coming, that is where we get listings from, is the people who come to the seminars. But some of them aren't even ready then, and we wind up doing a one-on-one with them. In some cases, we send them to an attorney because they need legal advice. It depends on the circumstances, but it's been a very successful action we've been doing for quite some time now.
The way you're promoting that, you mentioned, is these newspapers you're mailing out?
Well, in the news, we have it in our papers, we have it in our TV ad, we have it in our radio ad.
So you're promoting it all over?
Oh yeah, and it's on the website. I mean, we literally it's been a big part of what we're doing. We're talking about the HAFA program. We're not using the word HAFA in the ad, but find out about this free government program that pays you $3,000 to do a short sale. They won't know the word HAFA, so we're certainly not going to go HAFA on the air, just make it confusing to them, but we're definitely referring to the HAFA program. We explain it to them. We tell them, here's how you get in it, here's what you need to qualify for it, that kind of thing.
So the newspaper that you're sending out, what kind of promotion are you doing in it?
It used to be called Custom House, and now it's called Discover. They changed the name of the company, but Discover Publications, I've been with them, oh, God, I can't remember exactly, maybe 6-7 years. I have 4 zip codes, and then I have my personal list, which is about 6,000-7,000 papers a month. So it totals up around 43,000-44,000 copies a month we send out. And so on the back of it, we have testimonials that we knew from the previous month. We have testimonials, people telling how happy they are with us. And then we have the dates of our short sale seminars and why they should come to a short sale seminar. The front is an article we write each month talking about market conditions, that kind of thing.
The interior is designed by Discover Publications?
Yeah.
So you just put together the front and the back?
Yes. Well, it's actually customized. The paper itself is. No, I wouldn't want to say just the front and the back. That wouldn't be quite true, but it would be easier to explain it if I said yes. But we actually do quite a bit of stuff to it.
They set up a template.
Yes.
So you just have to go in and personalize it.
You could personalize it as much or as little as you wanted to. And I would think you'd be the most, like people who use it who don't personalize it much, I seriously doubt they're going to get quite the same impact from it. Like to use their generic article for the front page, I think is stupid, but I've seen it done. I just wouldn't do it.
Russell, how long have you been in the real estate business?
Started in 1978, so this is my 34th year.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
In that time, I imagine you've tried a lot of different things. What was your worst marketing method?
Well, I think going to an ad agency was one of the stupidest things we did to have the commercial made. I think that was a mistake. I wouldn't do that again. I wouldn't go to an ad agency to have them produce a commercial for me. I thought that was a waste. Let me think. Other things we did. I think when I first did a geographic farm and I didn't really understand, I think that was a waste of money. Like it takes a while to get a farm going is one thing. And that I think just not understanding that, you know, when people talk about farming, I think that they often have not considered that if you said the average turnover in any given area, in any normal time, is 7-8% a year. So at any given time when you mail out stuff to a farm, approximately the bulk of the people aren't going to be customers for you right now. So what you're really trying to do is not get them to sign up with you now, but you're attempting to embed yourself into their mind so that when they do need your service, you'll be the one they think of. Because most of them, if you just took 8% at the maximum turnover, and then you went, so in any given year, 92% aren't selling that year, only 8%. And you took the size of the farm, and let's say you had 1,000 houses, So you're going to have 80 sales that year. You get the idea. Now divide that number by 12, and you start to get the order of magnitude of even if you got all the sales, which isn't going to happen, that's not that much business. So how big does your farm need to be to support what you want to do? And realize that when you communicate to that size farm, you're communicating to people 12 times a year who mostly don't need you right now. So the communication you're sending might want to have that in mind, as opposed to a nonstop buy now, call me today, this is it, when most of them aren't going to find that fantastically appealing because it's not relevant to them. They don't need to call you now. You're not what they're looking for right now. They're not about to sell right now. So there's things like that. And how many mailings would you have to do to get proportionate to what you're trying to accomplish? And I think that I see that routinely wildly underestimated. But you see the same thing if I say, what's the most important skill for any agent to have of all the skills? And the answer is lead generation. Lead generation is more important than all the other activities combined, because you can do everything else perfectly, and if you do that one poorly, you're going to fail. If you do that one well enough, you could actually do everything else poorly and still succeed. So most agents underestimate how many leads they're going to need to succeed and survive and thrive, and they underestimate it wildly. Like, how many leads do you need, really? And I don't mean email addresses. How many leads do you need to make a sale? I see it today in internet leads where they haven't really studied it. And most of the people going around the country blathering about here's how to do it never successfully did it, which I think is astounding.
How many leads do you need to generate to create a sale?
Well, on that particular subject, what I found is that the average conversion, immediate conversion of internet leads is roughly between 90 and 100 to make one sale immediately. So when you start looking at that, like if you're talking about immediate sales with internet leads, it's about roughly between 90 and 100 to generate a closed deal. Interesting thing, the top, and for generating seller leads, I consider it pointless gibberish and don't even work on it. It's generating buyer leads, and for that, I'm going to say the best data I ever found was from Mitch Reback out of Melbourne, Florida. And a year before last, Mitch did 330 buyer deals. And Mitch's conversion, because of his drip system, is 1 out of 30. And so I just copied Mitch's drip system, and I used my number one expert site, one of the campaigns in my number one expert site, just set up a campaign to send out those letters on a routine basis. I've got 11,000 email addresses in that system that we send, and we'll do about we did last year maybe 130 buyer deals, and this year my target for number of buyer sides is 200.
On your seller side, how many leads do you need to generate in order to get a sale?
Oh, I don't know anymore. I used to know that number, but short sales threw it into the toilet. I don't know what the number is currently. I can tell you if I said for 15 years, depending on what market velocity was, I needed seller calls off the radio ad. I needed between 8 and 12. So if I ballparked it at 10, so for every 10 calls where someone called asking for what is really my pre-listing package, for every roughly over the years, for 15 years, my average number would have been 10 of those sent out equal to closed sale. Now, but the real number varied from a low of 8, but with the market changing, where people were calling and instantly listing with us, and it threw the numbers off. So in 2005, my stats went to hell on being able to track and use that as my market predictor, and I haven't gotten them back. I still don't have it. It jumps all over the place because of whether we're doing short sales or not, or this kind of thing. So. But if I were using listings as the yardstick and listing inquiries, it would be overall, over the years, this is not a current number, about 10 pre-listing packages equal to closed deal. And I believe we're coming back into a time that number would probably be about right.
I believe you mentioned that your early career for the first 12 years, you were an ordinary agent.
Yes.
And then you became an extraordinary agent.
Yes.
What was the difference? What happened?
Became a lister.
Became a lister.
I became a lister. I stopped running my ad in Homes Illustrated. I stopped working buyers. I literally burnt the bridge. Like, this is it. I have to learn to list. I didn't know how. I just wanted to learn and decided I was going to be a purist. I wasn't going to work buyers. I gave buyer leads away. I didn't want them. I didn't want to talk to buyers. I only wanted listings. And for several years, I mean, I wouldn't even allow buyer sides in the operation. Didn't want them. Didn't want them at all. Didn't want to screw with them. Didn't want to talk to a buyer. Just wanted listings. And I went after them with a single-mindedness, like, this is what I do. I take listings. Almost all, now Mitch is an exception, but almost all top agents around the country, if you look at the profile of successful top agents, they have a listings-based business. And so I took and went, where's the bulk of it come from? The security, the success, it's listings. Go after listings and learn to list. And so that was what I did. That's what I went after, listings. And I would say that to anyone. If you want to get security, this is not some new thing. It's actually a very old thing in the real estate business. But it's kind of gotten distorted by people, you know, social media and blah, 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 blah. The truth of the matter is you go out and get listings. And initially, you don't have the money to do fancy, expensive marketing, so you prospect for them. What's that? Well, you go door to door. Do whatever the hell you have to do. Get in front of someone. Find someone who's looking to sell a house and go in and talk to them about it. And at first, your presentation, mine certainly was extremely crude, and it gets better and better and better until finally you get kind of polished at doing it. But it takes lots and lots and lots of up-to-bats to get good.
Russell, what drives you?
Well, I don't know. It's funny because you get to different levels. What mostly happens with, I saw it happen with me, I see it happen with others. When you don't have any money or you don't have enough money, there's what drives you is money. But you get to a certain point and you plateau. And like if you haven't been making a good living, you get to start doing 60 deals a year. Well, all of a sudden you're not broke anymore. Then you want to get better, and you go to 100 deals a year. And then all of a sudden it plateaued again there for 3 years, and I pushed it to 200 deals. And you plateau there for a few years. But eventually, you know, I think what it probably comes down to is impact, not money, because you can't measure it in money. Like, why am I on this interview right now? Impact. It's like in Gary Keller's book. It says right on the cover, the millionaire real estate agent, it's not about the money. And you think, yes, it is. It's about the money. Actually, it isn't. There's a pride. It'd be like if you took the cello player, Yo-Yo Ma, does he play that well so he'll get more money? I don't think so. I think there's this pride in doing it really, really well, playing the game and winning. I think in the beginning, it is definitely, it's the money. I want the money. I need the money. But eventually, it's just the fun of doing it. It literally is the joy of doing it. And we've had some lean years, but we're back where we're playing the game, where it's just a fun game to play. And it's fun again. It's fun again. We're winning. We're doing really, really well again. The REO, I didn't want to get into the REO business and didn't, and I'm now glad I didn't. Most people who got into the REO business, it just spoiled them, so they couldn't ever really learn to do short sales. They'd talk about it, but they never could do it because they had poisoned themselves so much the whole time. And the REO, in my mind, does something really, really bad to the agent. It takes the most important skill there is for success, which is lead generation, and eliminates it from the equation. So they spend years not generating leads. And when the faucets turned off of this method that was just so fabulous, the single source for business, they don't really have a business. They don't have a business that they can then sort of repurpose, because it just simply went away. And very, very few agents ever make the transition from awesome volume as an REO agent into awesome volume as an agent. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it's very rare. And it's rare because the values and the internal viewpoint and the skill set that's required to be a great agent, to be a stably great agent, and not have that one great month. You know, again, when I go back to Gary Keller, you're not looking to have a good year. You're looking to have a great career. So what would you need to do? What would you need to know? And I couldn't over-recommend his book, The Millionaire Real Estate Agent, for someone who's looking for, like, how do I go from being an ordinary agent to a giant agent? There's the path right there. It's all written out. It's not a book on here's how to get listings. It's not a book on here's how to drum up some buyer business or here's how to get business from the internet. It's how do you go? What is the mindset? It's there, and I just couldn't over-recommend the book. I'm not with Keller Williams, and I think Gary is probably the smartest, most knowledgeable person on the face of the earth in the English-speaking language when it comes to useful information for success for agents. And I know that's quite a compliment, but I mean it from the bottom of my heart.
Russell, if you were to advise a brand new agent just getting into business, what would you tell them to do first?
Work buyers. Absolutely work buyers. I know at the real estate school they tell them work listings, but these are people telling them that who don't work listings themselves. So that's partially what's wrong with that advice. The other thing that's wrong with that advice is they're pitting an agent who doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground up against seasoned veterans. If you go back to an earlier statement of mine, which is buyers are not looking for an agent, they're looking for a house. So a relatively new agent who has a lockbox key, access to MLS, and a car and doesn't smell bad is actually quite acceptable to a buyer. Buyers are not looking for somebody who's going to sell them something. They're looking for someone who's honest and nice. So, like, the fact that I've been in business 34 years doesn't make me lots more desirable to most buyers than somebody 6 months in the business. So first of all, you don't have to compete with anyone. Just did you meet them and did they like you? You could sell them a house. That's number one. Go out and sell at least a dozen houses. Learn how the contract works. Learn how deals go together. Learn sort of the lay of the land and get your sea legs. Then learn to list. It's a different thing entirely. If I had anything to do over, it would be learn to list sooner. Learn to list. Learn to list. Learn to list. There's no substitute for it. And regardless of what any instructor anywhere teaches, my answer would be go on listing appointments. I don't care if you do every single thing wrong. Go on more of them. Keep going on appointments. Think of it as a comedian getting stage time, brand new comic getting stage time. Just go on appointments. Keep going on appointments. The minimum number of appointments they need to go on to sort of learn how to do it is 50. Like, say, I went on 10 appointments. You don't know. You don't know yet. At 20 appointments, you still don't know. At 50, now you've got, you've been up to, and this is at the table, where you sat at the table, in their kitchen table. All problems in getting listings are either at the table or getting to the table. And the biggest problem most agents have is actually not at the table, it's getting to the table. So if you have even a really stupid presentation, but you had enough up to bats, you'd learn to list and you'd wind up getting business to boot. So that'd be my answer.
Russell, do you think the top agent interviews like the one we're doing right now are valuable?
In most cases, yes. In some cases, absolutely not. I think there's a ton of top agents. I don't think I know for a fact that most successful agents don't actually know why they're successful. when I was on my way up, I made a list of all the top agents in town and would take them to lunch because I wanted to find out what they knew. And I would sit there across the table from them asking them questions. And at first I thought they were being real cagey with me and keeping the real secret good information back because I got the most gibberish answers you can imagine when I'd ask them, well, how do you get your business? And you'd get stuff like, well, the people just call me. I've been doing it a long. People just call me. People like me. And I go, yeah, but how did you get there? They obviously didn't know. Occasionally I find people falsifying stats, making outrageous claims that are just complete crap. How many referrals they get or how much their closing ratios are. Or they only takes them 7 sign calls to average a deal. I've heard that one, by the way. Out of every 7 random sign calls, they can get a closed escrow. And you think, God, I could never get that good. Yeah, neither could they. it's just crap. It just makes them seem so important to say stuff like that, apparently. But it's a lie. It's just a complete crock. It's not true. It wasn't for them. It never has been. And it's, you know, so part of it is, yes, it's good, but I think that a lot of times agents, I remember one in particular where I thought he didn't know why he was successful. I finally figured out why he was successful. He was amazing at asking for business because he'd reinvent his business about every 18 months. He couldn't, whatever he was doing, he was going to change it. So he never did anything very long. It's still true today, 25 years later. He still just changes it all the time. But he's a great salesman. He's constant. He's got a real hustle factor. So I think I'd go back to, you know, if some agent's not willing to hustle, I don't think it'll matter which seminars he goes to. I think in having correct technology, like, you know, I've seen in the last few years, most of the top agents have been REO agents. Do I think that's, you know, to me, maybe I have a huge bias because I'm not one or wasn't one, but do I think it's amazing to hear, oh, so-and-so sold? In fact, I think Brett Tanner was interviewed by you, right?
No, I haven't talked to Brett yet.
Now, see, Brett did a whole bunch of deals from REO, but I'll tell you something. Like, Brett is such an amazing young guy, just an amazing young guy, that he exudes success and people around him become more successful. But Brett he hustles. Brett hustles up business. But somebody who just latched on to a Fannie Mae account or something like that, I don't know. In some cases, the technique they used to get it, they were in a room when something happened. It's not like they went, oh my God, that's just brilliant. You know what I mean? And then the person sold 600 houses, and then the account goes away, and now their business goes back to nothing. There was a guy here in town. He was a $5 million a year guy, $3 to $5 million a year. At the height of the REO stuff, he was doing $90 million a year. He lost the accounts. He's back down to like $2 million a year, and he's never going back up. I go, I don't know. Was he successful? I guess sort of, but he can't replicate it. So I think that when a person can't go do it again, it's like someone says, I'm just amazing. Okay, do it again. If they can't do it again, then it doesn't have any value. If it can be like, what were the steps it took you to get that, and could you do it again and again? Like, for example, I could take my radio commercial. Is it something unique to my voice? No. Is it unique to Phoenix? No. If I tell you there's probably currently 25 agents in the country using my copy, my ad, my stuff all over the country that are successful radio ads. It's not my voice on their ad. It's here's copy that works. Here's buttons the public will respond to. Don't advertise on these stations. Advertise on that kind. Do I think it's good? Yeah, because it's not dependent on authority. You know what I'm saying? Like the atom bursts, whether Professor Einstein gives it permission to burst or not. So something either works or it doesn't. And I think when, as long as the stats that one claims are true and they could be replicated by anyone, like where someone goes, I want to do that too, I want to learn how to do that and follow that model, then I think it's fabulous. And I think it's the most important kind of education there is for our industry.
A duplicatable model.
There you go. There you go.
Well, Russell, I've gotten to the end of my questions. Is there anything else that you want to say we haven't talked about?
Yeah, there is. There is one thing. If I were going to impart one final piece of wisdom to anyone, there is a website called tipsforsuccess.org. Click on the part where it says articles or essays. I think it says articles. Tipsforsuccess.org. Click on articles. Scroll down to where it says Who's Stopping You, Part 1. That information I think of as the most valuable information I know, because if you have buyers or sellers or people you're connected to that make you feel crazy, that's the problem. Get rid of them. Like disconnect from those people. The biggest problem I see that makes agents leave the business is they get one of these nuts on their lines, and instead of just cutting the line, just write it down to the point where they can't stand being a realtor anymore. And if I were going to pick just a thing to go, here, this is important, learn this, it would be that.
It's okay to fire a client.
There you go. It's just, in fact, if you're not firing clients from time to time, you're doing something wrong. You aren't promoting enough.
Well, Russell, you brought us full circle back to the most important skill any agent needs, lead generation. You've mastered that and more. Your expertise in the area of radio advertising is superb. You really are the godfather of radio ads. You showed us that it's never too late to step up, learn new skills, and go from an ordinary agent to a giant, extraordinary agent. You've developed a duplicatable business that can operate independent of your day-to-day involvement, yet benefits from your leadership, guidance, and direction. You held firm to your convictions through the dramatic market meltdown and are reaping the benefits as the market corrects. It's no wonder you're a billion-dollar agent. You're an inspiration to all aspiring agents. Thank you again for being our top agent of the month.
You've been listening to the Mastermind Agent Interview of the Month Club, where top agents, rising agents, team members, and guests from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the club interviews at www.mastermindagent.com.